Hi, I'm Scott Jones. I'm director of the Electronic Frontiers Forums track at DragonCon. And this is the cryptography engineering panel. I would please ask the panelists to introduce themselves, and we'll get started.
All right. My name is Jeff Termeseisen. I worked for 11 and a half years at a company called Verint, where we did various forms of communications intercept from the this call may be monitored for quality assurance through to executing various law enforcement wiretap warrants and whatnot. I currently work for a financial company that processes payments for a number of large companies, small ones too, actually. And I'm currently studying my master's in cybersecurity.
So I'm Bruce Schneier. I've been doing cryptography since forever. Can you? All right. It's good. This is actually good because it gets a sound check. People in the back, can you hear me? Hooray. I've been doing cryptography since forever. Applied cryptography is my book. I've written a whole bunch since then. These days I do less cryptography than policy, but I still have a hash function in the current NIST hash function competition. So there's still some.
I'm Randall Schwartz. This is my 11th year here at DragonCon. Yay. My relation to cryptography is that when I was, I think, maybe 7 or 8, I grabbed a book on crypto, and I just was really excited about it. I've been playing with it ever since.
Thankfully, it wasn't my book.
No. Before that, yes. Right. It was really good, though, about codes and ciphers, and I thought, well, this is really amazing stuff, and I've really just sort of, in the meanwhile, tried to educate myself in every way possible to do that. I don't have a lot of implementation detail knowledge, but I am somebody who's very familiar with most of the technologies.
All right, so welcome. Thanks for coming. People standing in the back, there is a bunch of seats up front. Everyone with a hand up has an empty seat next to them. So all of you can come down. So the topic of this panel is cryptography engineering, which I like as a topic title. It's not cryptography, it's cryptography engineering. And really, this is the hard part. The mathematicians produce cryptography, and when cryptography breaks, invariably it's an engineering break and not a cryptography break. Now, not that there aren't cryptography breaks, but they're much less common than getting something wrong in the engineering. So you can think of cryptography as producing the algorithms, producing the protocols, and cryptography engineering as making it work in an actual system. So, you know, your cell phone has a bunch of cryptography in here. There's protection for the control channel. This one, because it's a browse the internet, it uses SSL. There's a lot more than math to make cryptography work, and that's the engineering. I remember at an RSA conference maybe a decade and a half ago, Bert Kalisky, who was then the chief scientist of RSA, talk about cryptography engineering and the need for engineers. That really we spent a lot of our time on the mathematics and then just waved our hands and say, well, you just make it work. And that turns out to be a very large hand wave and much harder than you think. So an example of an early cryptography engineering break was SSL 2.0. Right, perfectly fine cryptographic protocol designed to protect web traffic. And it was broken by a couple of grad students at Berkeley because the random number generator basically sucked. And it was very easy to predict what the key would be, not because the crypto was bad, but because the systems generating the keys for the crypto was bad. Now, this is probably the first time crypto security breaks hit the New York Times, kind of a big deal for our business. And you'll see that even today. You'll see fine crypto systems broken because people choose bad passwords. And getting people to choose good passwords is a matter of engineering. Or you'll see typos in the code. So instead of doing, I'm making this up, 16 rounds of a cipher, it does one. And nobody noticed. And since it's only communicating with itself, it's interoperable, but you got the engineering wrong. So that's... You know, that's sort of what I think of when I think of cryptographic engineering. It really is what cryptographers do most of the time. Right? It is rare that we invent algorithms. It is rare that we break algorithms. Much more often, we're trying to take existing pieces of cryptography and put them together into an actual system. And I mean, to me, this is the interesting part. This is the hard part. And this, when you break things, this is what you're gonna poke at until it breaks. Did someone want to add to?
It was beautiful.
Succinct, intelligent.
Okay, now we can go home.
Short panel today.
I got something there on actually breaking it. Triple DAs and AES are currently sort of probably the most widely implemented ones. And it's generally accepted that they can be broken, but it's so hard that it's usually, you know, a useless endeavor to try because of the time involved. How do you reckon things like quantum computers, when those finally become more widely available?
So this actually is kind of an interesting example of cryptography engineering. You know, quantum computers. Well, let's go to quantum cryptography first. There are, and these are as old as the mid 80s. The first papers in quantum cryptography came out of Brassard and Bennett in the 80s, where they theoretically showed that you can do key distribution, you can do coin flipping, and a number of very hard cryptographic things you can do relatively easy with quantum mechanics. Now. Right, but the step between the paper and making an actual system was about 20 years. You know, and now there are quantum cryptography products on the market. They don't sell very well because there's really no reason for them. But that was a whole lot of, you know, not cryptography engineering, but actual physics engineering. Quantum computers are the same way. You know, we have some very good theoretical results on quantum computers and what they can do to cryptography. And it's sort of someone invents a quantum computer, and the question is, what can you do with it? Well, the first thing you can do is break RSA. Well, what else can you do with it? You can break Diffie-Hellman. It's kind of a public key cryptography breaking machine. But that's the theory. I mean, the last I heard, we've built a quantum computer that can factor 15. Okay. Right, so getting it to the point where you can factor, you know, 4,000-bit numbers that we might be using today is, you know, 20, 30, 40, maybe never, years into the future. And so, and that's a lot of engineering. So that's that step between the academic paper, right? Someone writes a paper on AES and then putting it into a system, right? Putting it into this phone is a lot more than just writing the software to make it work.
So I'm actually curious about your point of view, to ask a question here, about this arms race that seems to keep going on for things like, you know, jailbreaking the iPhone and, you know, web getting cracked and things like that. Are the errors there because humans are involved in implementing this stuff and we always will make some mistakes, or is there always going to be some crypto that it just takes a smarter person to break it?
Well, see, but it's not the crypto that's broken. And this is sort of another reason why you rarely see crypto breaks. I'm going to do just a little bit of hand-waving here. If you think about cryptography and algorithms and a brute force search, when you add an extra key bit, right, you make the key from 100 bits to 101 bits, you double the amount of time it takes to break. Right, you have a 56-bit key that was DES, 128-bit key that's AES. You increase the time to break by 2 to the 72, right, an enormous number. Which means and you've increased the time or the complexity you encrypt linearly. Right, so it might take to double the key length, it'll take double the work to encrypt, where it takes 2 to the n work to break. So there's an inherent mathematical advantage on the side of the cryptographer. Right? I increase my key from 100 bits to 101 bits. My difficulty to encrypt is going to increase by 1%. Difficulty to break has doubled. Right? So, and that is sort of a fundamental mathematical imbalance. One of the reasons why we can now very easily design ciphers that to break require computers the size of the universe and all the time, you know, all the times at the beginning of time, times a billion. I mean, you can produce algorithms with numbers that are just ridiculous. Now, of course, cryptography is all about finding shortcuts, right? Cryptanalysis, you know, can I reduce the key space by a factor of 2, a factor of 4? Can I increase my time to break by a factor of 16, a factor of 28? Right? But it's still a game that I, as a designer, am going to win. Right? Even think of something like RSA, where, you know, factoring is getting better. Every few years, we see new factoring records. But, you know, I can just double my key length every once in a while, and I'm going to stay way ahead of you. Right? It's not even hard. Right? So you have that imbalance. When you see the breaks, right, as you said, they tend to be breaks in the implementation. Right? It's a software error. Right? Someone left the key in a buffer somewhere. Right? And a fine example of cryptography engineering attacks is a term I invented for this in the 90s called side channel attacks. Right? The first one that came out was timing. Right? Can we learn the key just by monitoring how fast the encryption happens? And if you think about the hardware, the encryption is going through gates, and some gates are slower than others. And you have an algorithm like RSA, which is doing factoring. Right? Depending on how the implementation is, you can see differences. You put the chip under an oscilloscope, you can see power fluctuations, you can see timing fluctuations, and you can do quite a lot of cryptanalysis. Nothing wrong with the algorithm. It's all implementation. Right? So the breaks we're seeing invariably are breaks in implementation. Now, in implementation, you just don't have that imbalance. Right, I write better code and you get better analyzing code. Then I write a little better code and you get a little better analyzing. There's a lot of parity here. Right? I mean, you talked about it as an arms race. It really is an arms race. Right? I patch, you find a new break. I patch again, you find a new break. And one of the questions, I mean, the question he asked, which sort of I finally got to, is why? The real question is, are bugs sparse or numerous? That's the question, and it's an interesting one, and there's been some good research on this. And we have data, right? You have a version of Microsoft operating system. We can chart the number of security flaws found over time. Right? If bugs were sparse, the curve would look like this. Right? As you find them, they become less likely you'll find another one. If bugs are numerous, it'll be much flatter. Because you're finding a very, very small percentage of the total bugs, so you're not changing the probability you'll find a new one as you find them. And the results are that bugs are numerous, that we are actually not good at writing secure code. We've gotten better at it. Microsoft is a great example of a company that, 10 years ago, decided to take security seriously, and they really have. They've gotten a lot better at producing secure code. I mean, the stuff they have is so much higher quality than it was. Fortunately, Microsoft, you know, holds a huge legacy in their OS. And it might take a 10, 20 years to wash out the old stuff. But, you know, the new stuff is a lot better. We're better at automatic tools. We're finding things like buffer overflows and cross-site scripting. You know, some of the common bugs. But still, we find that invariably, there's a number of bugs per 1,000 lines of code or 10,000 lines of code that seems to be relatively constant. That we're not really getting better at that. We are getting better at recovering from flaws. Microsoft patches once a month. This thing probably patches invisibly when we're not even paying attention. Now we're getting better at detecting. You'll have an antivirus program on your computer which will detect things as they happen. So we're building infrastructure around what's in secure code. But this is probably less cryptography engineering and more security engineering. Right? All the things around security that aren't cryptography. I mean, I always like to think of cryptography as, I think of a door lock. Cryptography is how the pins in the lock work. Now that's really important, but you know, I could still throw a rock through your window. Right, and all the dinking with those pins is not going to make that rock any less able to break your window. This is kind of a long-winded answer.
It's great.
Are there any other chairs up front? Anybody? No.
Wow.
So you guys are standing. Sorry. Like halfway through, you could swap or something. All right, so we're happy to take questions from the floor. All right.
Where's our runner?
Someone be in charge of...
Back there.
Hi, how's it going? Thank you so much for being here. Could the panel comment on the MD5 collision attack that we saw with Flame recently?
Anybody?
Not for you.
I can't even Google for it.
Oh, okay. You know, I want to know more than I do. Unfortunately, I'm not gonna do this justice. For those who don't know, MD5 is a hash function. Hash functions are the workhorse of cryptography. They use much more than encryption algorithms. They're used in every cryptographic protocol ever written. They are used to mask passwords. They are used in public key cryptography and symmetric cryptography. All protocols use them. They're absolutely everywhere. The first popular hash function was called MD4. MD4. And invented by Ron Rivest, a cryptographer at MIT, the R and RSA. There were problems with that. He wrote MD5. That was replaced by the federal standard SHA, became SHA-1, and now there's a hash run competition for SHA-3. MD5 is used a lot. There's someone at Microsoft whose job it is to remove MD5 from Windows. It is a full-time job, and he's not done yet. Right? And then this is the Microsoft legacy code problem. MD5 hasn't broken pretty severely that you can find collisions. And there are different types of collisions. I'm not going to go into that. But... You know, if you find collisions, you can forge documents. And in the case of Flame is, I guess, another back explanation. Flame is the second military-grade cyber weapon we've seen. First one is, I don't blank on the name. Stuxnet, thank you. Second one is Flame. Stuxnet was designed for to do damage. Flame is an espionage tool, which actually could, in theory, carry a more malicious payload. Flame was discovered in computers across the Middle East.
Banking computers.
Yeah, banking and elsewhere. Right, it's believed it's American in origin. Like all cyber weapons, they don't carry return addresses. It's very hard to look at. You know, there's no flag painted on the fuselage you can look at. I'm giving a talk at Cyber War on Sunday where I'll talk about this exact problem. One of the things Flame did is it fooled the Microsoft update system, making computers believe it was a legitimate software update. And it did that by breaking MD5, by making fraudulent certificates, by breaking MD5. It was a particular style of break we hadn't seen before, and that's what made it interesting. And that's also makes you believe that there was a government behind this, and it wasn't just a hobbyist. And there was actually serious math embedded within Flame. I don't know if I answered that enough.
I was wondering if you could go into exactly how the MD5 collision worked.
No.
But Flame does raise an interesting point of how's the landscape changing now that we've got state-sponsored cryptographers that are, writing code that's being released into the outside world and no longer being kept on things like SuperNet, and you know we're now getting these things going into the real world with huge amounts of resources that your average hacker doesn't really have access to. How much of a change is that going to be, make the playing field now, in 5 or 10 years down the line when these guys start retiring or crime syndicates start hiring them at way higher rates than what the government's paying? You know, you've got these folk who've literally been trained by the government with, like, unlimited resources who are now getting into the commercial market working for crime syndicates.
Yeah, it's actually even worse than that. And if we fire a Tomahawk cruise missile at somebody, they're not going to learn much from the wreckage. If we fire a cyber weapon at them, they can disassemble it and learn a lot from it.
Turn it back around.
I mean cyber weapons, there's a much, much steeper learning curve. Right? Not steeper in that it's harder, it's steeper that it happens faster. because you give away a lot more secrets when you deploy a cyber weapon than you do when you deploy a tank. Okay, you're in charge of the mic. You have to pick the people.
You pick.
He had his hand up first, though.
All right.
Second row here, black T-shirt.
Second row, the second row's
here.
Up front.
The other second row.
They're linear.
Not after this long.
There's been sort of a resurgence of work and verification in the past couple of years, which actually seems to be unlike before going anywhere. How do you see that affecting the security, the world of engineering security?
What do you mean? What do you mean by verification?
Proving programs and systems correct. Mathematically.
I don't know much about that. I know it's still real hard. And this is one of the problems we have in security. I mean, can we prove a program is secure? We can barely prove it terminates for anything other than toy programs. What I know about verification is that it tends to be spotty, that it can be specific things, that it does certain things. But security is all about the thing you haven't heard of before. And a lot of security engineering involves checklists. Now, does it do you have a checklist of good behavior that you should be doing and bad behavior you shouldn't be doing. But the good attacks are not going to be on your checklist.
And then we go back to what you're saying about the problems in the code, not in actual cryptography, because you can't really test to see if someone screwed up a line of code somewhere until it actually happens.
Right. Well, we can always add a regression test that keeps us doing that again, but if that just becomes another line item, but it wasn't there when we wrote the code, it's not going to be any good.
Someone there might have someone relevant to say. Your hand looks relevant.
And on the relevant.
So this kind of ties into verification and what Bruce was saying earlier about how we're getting better at developing tools to find bugs. But a few years ago, it was a well-meaning person working on the Debian project who ran some static source code analysis, and it said that, this key generation algorithm was generating unpredictable code paths, and he replaced it with a much more predictable, RAND function, and that is what led to their whole, SSH debacle a few years ago. Just wanted to toss that out there.
Nice.
On a similar note, in the aviation world, you do see a lot of it, verification for determinism in flight critical programs. You see a lot of that, though, where the system isn't interacting with a lot of systems in unpredictable ways. And so you can do a lot of verification. You see that a lot with discussions of things like structural coverage for have you tested the code to prove that it does what you expect, but I haven't seen much effective on the security side.
See, I think the problem is you're also inherently limited to what you can think up. And, there's no way you can think of every possible situation that's going to come up until it comes up.
And also like the Air France crash in the middle of the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, there was because it was starting to get confusing sensors for the Airbus to figure out what it should actually be doing. Of course, they had bad training on the pilots, too, but who didn't realize that they had to override what was going on, but the autopilot was not flying the plane right because it had a most confusing set of inputs that it would have ever gotten.
So avionics is a good example. Right? That's a place where we spend a lot of time and a lot of money making sure the code behaves properly. And anybody who's worked in software avionics, the software that actually runs on the avionics bus, that moves the airlines and actually flies the plane, it is very, very expensive, it is very time-consuming, it is very slow. But it's very important. That kind of work, tends to be simpler systems. Some of them said they tend not to interact with other systems. And you really can't, for any reasonable amount of money, apply it to the iPhone, the Windows, any commercial code, just because the market won't pay for that in a way that an airplane market will, primarily because of government regulation. Right, so it's very hard to make that scale. The other thing is that when you are doing that kind of analysis, you're basically programming Murphy's computer. Right? You're programming a computer that will make mistakes, will screw up, and you want it to fail safely. My colleague from Cambridge, Ross Anderson, coined the phrase a number of years ago, programming Satan's computer. Right, and this is fundamentally different in a very important way. Instead of programming a computer that makes random mistakes once in a while, randomly to do random things, you're programming a computer that will deliberately make the worst possible mistake at the worst possible time, designed to do the worst possible thing, and will keep doing that every week until you fix it. Right, you have an intelligent and malicious adversary inside your system.
Like Chaos Monkey just got released like that.
Right, so securing against that is fundamentally different than securing against randomness. Right, we can build a house that's secure against tornadoes. That's easy. Right, securing against guys with random weapons is a lot harder because you don't actually know what the weapons are, or which direction they're coming from, or what tactics they'll use. Right. And once you design your house, they'll look at it and say, oh, yeah, there's a weak point there, haha, which tornadoes never do. Right. So that makes this a much harder engineering problem. But the avionics industry is actually a good thing to look at when you look at some of the good software coding practices.
I remember reading an article about the guys who were programming the shuttle. And they were actually running, up until it was decommissioned, they were running like on Commodore 64 level systems. And they ran through the code like 5 or 6 times. And the code was, I think it was 17,000 lines. And in those 4 or 5 times, different releases, they found 19 bugs.
Wow.
That was it. I think they said like on a corporate level, the average would have been something like 5 or 6,000.
Well, another example of this is the Curiosity Lander, of course. The amount of code that's in that and the amount of testing you have to go through.
Exactly.
And not even having access to the live environment to do the final testing. And the only glitch we've had so far was some of the dust kicked up, knocked out one of the weather sensors. I consider that a pretty good accomplishment. But look at the amount of people that it took to build something that effective and be able to do it right. So we have to apply some of that same level to crypto.
Anyone have any idea what secures a telemetry link? I sure don't know. Find someone else.
All right. Just microphone guys, pick guys. It's fine. Oh, got one?
Well, my question is, whenever you have an infrastructure and, say, whether you're a sysadmin or you're your security officer, how do you make the determination against, depending on what type of information you have, whether it be medical records or financial information, that with what's out there, trying to determine a type of encryption that is not going to totally bog down your system and cause halts and crashes?
You spend lots and lots and lots of money. Usually regulations specify a minimum of how good it has to be. Like PCI regulations, they come and do an audit and whatnot. For example, we've got a machine that the only thing it does is encrypts and decrypts. It does absolutely nothing else. You have to have at least two of these things on either side to encrypt one side and decrypt the other side, and they run for like 30,000 each. And that's just for one link. Now, if you're a bank, you may be talking to multiple interchange, multiple other banks, you may need 15, 20 of these things. And, so it gets really expensive really fast. They're very nice devices, and they do cryptography really, really well, but they're not cheap.
So I'm going to answer this question a very different way. You ask, I think, one of the fundamental questions of society. Right? I live in a society where there's division of labor. I do not have expertise in topic X. How do I pick one of the things to get in topic X, right? I'm not a doctor. How do I know which doctor to go to that will cure me and not just charge my money? I mean, I want to go out to dinner. How do I pick a restaurant that will taste good and not poison me? Right? I'm a company and I have to pick a tax preparer. How do I know which one will do a good job and not cheat me? Right? Perfectly reasonable questions. And cryptography is just another one. Right, I have these cryptographic needs. I have data I need to keep secure. How do I know what to buy? How do I know what to do?
Consensus.
Okay. We heard consensus. We heard research. Anything else?
Peer review.
Use them all.
Use them all.
Regulation. All right. Okay. The common denominator in all of these is you trust somebody. Right. You trust somebody. I ask you, what's a good restaurant within 2 blocks of this place? Right? What's a good doctor? Well, the licensing, right? I'm trusting a government licensing. Someone said, do the research. I'm trusting a bunch of researchers. this is the way society works. This is actually the topic of my latest book, which I'll be talking about tomorrow at some time, I forget. This is hard. This is not easy, because in the end, you trust somebody, you close your eyes, and you jump. Most of the time, amazingly enough, that turns out okay. But, you know, in security, where we're sort of got our, you know, our paranoia antenna up, it feels weirder. Right? It's no different than picking a doctor. But it feels, because it's security. Right? You're going to trust, you know, my laptop's encrypted with PGP disk. Right? I'm trusting PGP. I could use Microsoft BitLocker. I'm trusting them. You know, how are you encrypting your email, or, you know, whatever it is you're doing in security, right? I'm building some banking subsystems. You know, which vendor do I use? Sometimes I'm told by standards bodies what to do. I have to trust that the vendor implements the standards properly. And so, and this is, I mean, I think it's interesting. I think the social dynamics of this is absolutely fascinating. But it is a much more general question than security. And security isn't going to be even the biggest place your company's going to do trusting.
Right.
Right. You know, you're going to trust your bank a lot more. You're going to trust your sysadmin a lot more. No, this person seems intent.
The difference of going to the doctor and going to where most companies go to get security advice is that when the doctor gives you wrong advice, you can go back and sue them. You can go back and do a different... And the doctors are, in a way, licensed and professionals. We don't have that in the security industry, so the advice that you get varies significantly from one company to one individual to one organization to the other. So that's the problem that was there.
And it's actually real interesting, because think of what we've done in society. We've said that we have to trust doctors. We kind of don't like that, so we're going to build this security mechanism effectively, right? We're going to build this lawsuit mechanism that will incent the doctors to behave in a, you know, more doctorly manner, because if they don't, they will get sued.
But we
decide that we will have some kind of licensing requirement, that they must produce some government credential, that they've had some amount of training and some amount of expertise, because before that, anybody could hold a shingle out. And what you're saying in security is you've really got more of the Wild West type environment. And that's really true. And that makes it hard.
Yeah, there's a minimum curriculum and a minimum syllabus that a doctor has to go through. When you go to a security expert and ask them, it really depends upon the track record of that person, the track record of the company, of who you go to.
Sure. And reputation is a fine way of choosing a doctor, restaurant, security engineer. There is credentialing in security, right? There's CISSP credentialing. I mean, you can complain, and a lot of them don't work very well, but these are attempts to get these same sorts of... Economists call these signals. Right? A signal is a way that... a seller can signal to a buyer that he is a reputable buyer, right? Warranty is a signal. Licensing is a signal. There are a whole bunch of them. Reviews, right? You see a lot of magazine reviews, awards from magazines. Those are signals in our industry. And we have a whole series of things we use. Remember the phrase, no one ever got fired from buying IBM? Right? That's the solution to this problem. I don't know what to buy, but I've heard of IBM. I won't get fired for buying them. They may not be the best, but they're not going to suck.
I wanted to bring it back to something practical on this that follows on from this question. There's been a lot of password database breaches, and with the hashing algorithms, people, that there has been some debate out there of whether a password that's hashed with a good salt and a reasonable fast hash mechanism versus a slow hash mechanism like bcrypt or something like that is the right way of going. What's your kind of advice on this?
Is it me?
I think it's...
I guess it's me again. all right, so the general problem... I'll give the general problem. For passwords, for offline attacks... So the threat model is we have a file of encrypted passwords and someone steals it. And how can they reverse engineer the passwords? Now, these passwords are hashed, So it's a bunch of string of random digits. But the way you break them is you take common passwords like password or password one, you hash it, and you see if it matches. Right? That is a very common attack, and it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. The way to solve that is something called SALT. So what you would do as the defender is instead of storing just the hash password, you take the password, you take a random number, you attach the two of them, and you'd hash that. And then you'd store the hash and then the random number. So to try password, if the SALT is, I'm making this up, 32 bits long, you actually have to try 2 to the 32 different hashes to see if you're right. So it greatly increases the work the bad guy has to do. Right, that's sort of very general. And the question he's asking, I think if I got this right, is are you better off using more SALT, right, or are you better off using a slower hash function? Because another way to slow down the attacker is to iterate the hash function, I don't know, 1,000 times. Right, increases his work by 1,000. And the answer to the question is yes, right? I mean, both of these techniques are good. There's actually a really good paper that came out about a week and a half ago. I'm going to blog about this next week, so go and look, because I was waiting for a commentary by someone else on this paper before I blogged about it, on modern password cracking techniques and how they changed the past few years. We've gotten a lot of data. One of the kind of neat side effects of a lot of these massive password hacks is sometimes the password is stored in the clear, and sometimes the hackers drop them when they're running away. So we as researchers get these huge files of passwords, and we can run statistics, right? How many people choose password or password one or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, right? How many choose dictionary words or a year or dictionary word and a number? And we've got all of that data. We kind of know exactly how lousy passwords are, and they're really lousy.
Yeah.
You know, against those kind of users, both of these techniques fall short. Because computers have gotten really, really fast. Right? And breaking passwords is just the sort of thing you want a computer to do. It's like really boring and really repetitive. Right? It's a trivial thing to send, you know, a parallel cluster to work at, or a distributed system. So all those techniques are good, but we really need people to choose better passwords.
One of the things you got to consider in SALT versus hash is that SALT is a defense against the amount of storage the hacker has.
Yeah.
Hash is a defense against the amount of CPU the hacker has. Once you have enough SALT where they can't store rainbow tables for all possible SALTs, you've won that game. So you don't need any more SALT. It's not going to give you any extra benefit at that point. But we have to then guess how much space, how much memory, how much disk an attacker is willing to have. And that's what's going to define our SALT size.
Someone up front.
Well,
he's not up front. He's on the side.
Next up, this guy in the blue, he said he's in it for like forever.
So I have a practical question. I happen to do ASP.NET web development for a company that does credit card work, basically. And I don't consider myself stupid, but when it comes to crypto engineering, I don't really know what I'm doing. I've made efforts to learn it and know how the code works and so on. But I assume that there's lots of people like me who have good intentions, but they don't know how to get better. And when you work in a small business, you know, you have time pressure and so on, and you have to get it done quickly. So how do you get better practically? And for you on the panel, the code that you've written, do you trust it? How did you get better?
One of the ways I got better was to keep looking at everybody else's code, especially the code that I found out was broken. But another great way is to be able to recognize just plain old goofy code. I mean, how many people here know about the dailywtf.com? I think that should be required reading for anybody who writes code. If for those of you that don't know about it, didn't raise your hand, every day there are code examples in there that you just jaw-dropping, like somebody actually wrote this. But you have to remember that somebody actually wrote that, so what was their thinking to get to there? If you can avoid the same sort of mistakes in your coding style, in your design, you'll be a lot further along. And my goal is always to never write anything that's going to end up there, right? Unfortunately, I've seen a lot of my clients' codes when I come in and get brought in to mop up stuff, that I look at it and go, my God, that I could take that example right there. I could take this piece of code here. So there are a lot of not so bright programmers out there, and I think we're just going to have to live with that. But the job is to not be one of those.
In something like the financial industry, though, you do have somewhat of an advantage because of the liability issues. So a lot of times, if you make a well-reasoned argument to the company, you can very possibly get training out of them. You know, where you can actually go on courses to learn it, and not necessarily just coding courses. You know, take a couple math classes. Khan Academy, I know, has got some really good math classes for free. MIT and Stanford now have started publishing all kinds of classes online as well. It really depends on how much work you're going to do on your own versus how much work you can talk the company into letting you do on company time.
And also how much work you can avoid doing. I mean, really, in the end, if you're not a doctor, you actually want to do as little surgery as you can get away with. Right? The more surgery you do, the more you're likely to screw up. And if you're not a crypto engineer, the less crypto engineering you do, the better off you're going to be. Right? So the more you can rely on off-the-shelf products, off-the-shelf libraries, off-the-shelf software, off-the-shelf systems, protocols, right? The less you can do, the better off you are. I'll see argued relatively regularly amongst amateurs that you want to be different because by different you're more secure. That's really a bad way to think. You know, there's security in following the herd because the herd pays attention, right? Collectively, we know that an algorithm is good. If you've designed something new, the odds of being good are really, really small. It's like going to a doctor and him saying, "Well, I know everyone else uses penicillin, but I use ground up pretzels." I mean, you got to look at him a little bit funny. I mean, everyone else uses penicillin. What are you doing? So the less you have to roll your own, the better off you are. If you do have to roll your own, and sometimes you do, right? You try to be as simple as you can. You do learn what you can. I mean, there are books. I actually wrote a book called Cryptography Engineering, which I probably should have brought to hold up, but I wasn't thinking. Right? Which tries to address, you know, some of the basic crypto engineering that you might want to do. But, you know, even then, I wouldn't recommend someone to read the book and design a secure system. The odds are pretty low.
I mean, so if you really get stuck, you just hire Bruce.
Or many people like me. But unfortunately, people who do that are going to be expensive. And that's where the less you have to roll your own, the better off you'll be.
You could also keep in mind that you can implement most of the code, but
someone else has a copy of it.
Yeah. So go ahead and implement the code, but bring in a sharp person to review your code. And through that sort of code review process, you'll actually learn some things you didn't before. So that's worth somebody else's smarter, more expensive time to review your code once it's done.
You know, I don't know the standard. I tend to be very freeform when I review code. I mean, I actually don't like checklists. I have a much more gestalt way of doing it. And you know, you never find stuff you don't break. I mean, you never do. It's kind of impressive. But I actually don't have a list of stuff I go through.
One thing that I'm interested in is the design of systems. It seems to me that a lot of the weaknesses in secure systems these days are the people using them, mm-hmm. right? So one of the things I'm interested in is, what about systems that in the threat model include either a complicit user, either through incompetence, no matter how many times you tell them they choose the password, or one who is actively turned against the system, perhaps through no fault of their own. There's a XKCD comic by Randall Monroe which illustrates this, which is you have the choice between buying a $500,000 supercomputer to break the password or a $5 wrench, and you beat them with it until they give it to you.
Yeah, right. We've called that rubber hose cryptography.
Right. So what systems are there out there, and what techniques are there for building systems that are defensible against even complicit nature of the people using them, protecting them from themselves?
That's where your group policies and things come in, like your complexity and your passwords and whatnot. You know, how often you have to change your password, how long your password has to be minimum characters, what it has to contain, how many have to be unique before you can start reusing them, whether it does things like allowing repeating characters, that sort of thing. That's really going to be your front line, because you're taking the choice away from the user there, and you're essentially forcing them into some, you know, into using a particular model. Your problem there becomes when they've got like 10 different systems that they've got to sign into, and they've got 10, you know, 15 character long patches they've got to memorize. Odds are they're not going to remember those. So they're going to wind up doing something stupid like writing them down, which is right where you go back to, you know, being insecure again. But fortunately, there are some programs out there which you can actually store passwords like that in. And you can either enter your own or you can have it generated. And I rather like the generated ones because they are pretty random. And I like the idea that, you know, if someone actually breaks it, they're still looking at what looks like an encrypted, you know, string, because there's absolutely nothing that's legible about that password as far as like a dictionary word or anything. It is completely random. That's probably going to be your best line of defense as a first line anyway, because you're essentially removing the user from the equation. You're saying, here's what you will do, not please will you do this.
One trap you fall into, though, with those policies about passwords, and this actually ended up with the Daily WTF one time, is that if they're designed by people who don't understand crypto very well, you can actually end up reducing the key space of what the cracker has to search to something incredibly small. If it has to have like one uppercase letter, one lowercase letter, three digits, and you know, some sequence of things, and it can't have a month, a minute, or a year, you start reducing the key space.
A smiley face and then a planet.
Yeah, that's what's left, right.
Can't use Pluto, though.
So again, we shouldn't have amateurs doing crypto, and this is part of that.
So to your general question, cryptographers do assume that the bad guys inside. This is the programming Satan's computer model, right? We are assuming a malicious, intelligent adversary inside your system. And when you look at protocol design papers from the 90s, sort of those golden years of protocol design, you saw very much the model that, you know, can the players in the protocol subvert the protocol? I see a lot of systems diagrams that assume that have the bad guy as part of the system. Because really what you're trying to do is that you want to constrain that bad guy's behavior. I mean, that's your model. So I think that is the right way of thinking about security, that the bad guy isn't outside the system trying to get in, that he's part of the system, and you want to constrain what he can do to the rest of the system. And so I don't think that's a sort of a new way of thinking. That's something I think we've been doing for a while. I've been more or less good at it. But that is the proper model of security. We're going to go way back to that.
I was just wondering if there were any security systems in computers in older computers that have been like lost in modern computers that were good and shouldn't have been lost.
Multics.
Like the Burroughs 5000 architecture model that prevented buffer overflows,
right,
and stuff like that?
Yeah, there have. I mean, when microcomputer, when Windows took over as sort of the premier OS, you lost a whole lot of security and reliability that you had in the older, stronger, more robust systems. So yeah, we have lost a lot. I mean, we're getting it back slowly, just because, you know, right, it's just getting bigger and more complex. But you know, Multics is a great example of a very old, very secure OS that was designed really well, and there's still stuff that could do that we've lost.
There's also the 8960, which had this the XA mode, which has a very interesting object model with a lot of security built in. That was from the same people that brought us the 432 ahead of that, but yeah.
Oh, you with the microphone. Hand it to somebody. They're all grabbing for it.
It was softball for Bruce. The new book, as I haven't read it, I'm afraid. But reading your blog, it seems to be about societal trust models, and many times in this discussion, we've talked about the cryptography engineering kind of getting past technology into bigger stuff. And I'm wondering if you've got any insight. Maybe you can just tell me to go buy your book, but engineering points in society trust models, things that we can manipulate, plan, perhaps at a corporate level, perhaps at a community level or market stock exchange? I don't know.
It's a good question. I almost rather save it to tomorrow where I'm talking about the book because it really isn't fit here. By the way, this is it. And I know two booksellers, wherever the booksellers are, have it. I have not seen them yet, but I've been told that they have it. So, let me say that. I mean, that really is off this topic. So I'd just as soon save that to tomorrow when I talk about trust in the book. Like any other engineering discipline in cryptography engineering, you do have to trust your engineers. We do it in the real world without thinking. I mean, none of us are thinking, oh my God, did the building engineers design this building properly? Is the ceiling going to fall on our heads in the next 10 minutes, right? None of us pretty much ever think that because we've built a system of civil engineering in our society that is so trustworthy that we could ignore it. I mean, the cool thing about trust is when it works well, you don't even notice it. Only when it starts failing do you start noticing it around. And all security is the same way. When security is working, you never notice it. It's all infrastructure. Right? You never walk by your sysadmin and say, the internet's working today, great job. You never, ever say that.
Never heard that.
Right? All
never
you ever say that. Is it's not working, you're doing a terrible job.
Yes.
Right? And that's the beauty of infrastructure. Right? When it becomes so reliable that it fades into the background and allows us to do things using it. Right? The neat thing about cryptography, about security, is that when it works, we just, go banking. We just buy stuff. We just, send messages on Facebook knowing that our parents can't read them. I mean, we just do it. And only when it starts failing do we start wondering, oh, should I do that?
How about this?
All right, you have someone? Okay.
So, back on topic. Practical question here. From your experience, have you found any correlation between good cryptography engineering and number of people working on a team?
What an interesting question.
Many hands spoil the crypto.
What an interesting question you ask. I don't know, but I can't say I've paid attention. I mean, we know a lot about software development and teams. Some really interesting work on size of teams that are good. There's this work on whether teams should have even or odd numbers of people, and that makes a big difference. I mean, really nice psychological work on teams and how they work together. And I'm willing to bet that all just transfers right into security. There's nothing magic about security. I don't know. It seems like the best standards we've gotten in security are not standards that are generated by consensus, because consensus is a really bad way for security. Because you don't want consensus is, well, let's have it do everything. Let's split the difference. Security never works that way. The best security protocols are when there is an open public competition or different groups vying for the standard. That it's a public process, but it's different groups working independently to create it. I mean, AES was done by an open competition. NIST held a competition for a new encryption algorithm, like 2000, and they invited anybody to submit one. They got basically 16 submissions, and it was great. We got a really good standard out of it. Those kind of models tend to work, and in that process, you had groups ranging from one to I think a dozen. Those are the team sizes, and I can't think of any correlation between team size and quality. Certainly, more than one is good, right? You like to have lots of people looking at something, but how formally, informally, it really depends. It's actually a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
I've seen discussion about the 3 G's principle for security and the importance of physical security, 3 G's being gates, guards, and guns. To what extent is it even possible to design a system, say like a smartphone, where if your threat is going to have access to the physical hardware doing the encryption, that is it even possible to design that to be well defended against someone simply bypassing the the crypto entirely and doing things like modifying your hardware to take control of what's going into your memory so that data is stored in the clear, etc.
Yeah, that has been done on a number of platforms. There's a company called IronKey that makes USB drives, and they're designed specifically against that sort of attack. At a software level, it's actually got an additional chip on there that pretty much just keeps things like passwords, because you have to actually log into the USB device. And I know if you get more than like 10 wrong, it wipes the drive automatically. But after they actually make it, they fill it with an epoxy so that every component is covered. And the epoxy is actually designed that it'll shatter the chips themselves before you can actually remove the epoxy. On a more commercial level, there's a company called Thales who makes encryption hardware devices. And they've actually got a, looks like a normal server rack, but inside there, there's actually a separate component that is isolated from everything else except by whatever pins it's using to connect. But it's got things like light sensors, motion detectors, anything like that. So if you start fiddling with the hardware, it's actually designed that nothing is kept stored somewhere that's not RAM, basically. And if any one of these triggers trip, it wipes RAM. So that, you know, there's absolutely no way you can recover that because it was never stored somewhere. It was kept in memory the whole time. But again, those are expensive, and I don't know how well those would translate, but the technology is physically there. Whether it's affordable is something else.
But the question you're asking is interesting. The question you're asking is basically, you know, what about the stuff that bypasses the cryptography and completely? Right? So we could imagine a cryptographic system that does email, right? I encrypt the email, send it to you, and you encrypt the email, send it to me. Right? It's secure against, you know, him in the middle eavesdropping, but not against him standing behind my screen watching me read the mail. Or a camera, right, watching me read the mail. Or a Tempest receiver, right, receiving electronic emanations of my screen as I read the mail. Or a Trojan in my computer.
Keyloggers.
Right, keylogger. Right, right, by watching the video stream coming out onto my screen. And so, I mean, all of those attack mechanisms are perfectly legal, are perfectly reasonable. And even if you have perfectly secure email cryptography, they're going to break the security of your system, right? Because you're just attacking it after the receiver of the mail has put into plain text or before the sender has put into ciphertext. And those attacks are always possible. Right? But you're never going to make them go away because, I mean, the system I'm trying to secure is, you know, the stuff in my head getting into your head without him knowing what it is. Right? And cryptography secures my computer to your computer, you know, but that link between the screen and the chair, that's a really hard one to secure.
Pipkek.
Right, so those attacks are increasingly common. I mean, if you think of how bank accounts are attacked these days, it tends to be Trojans in people's computers that do things in the background. Doesn't matter how good the crypto is, right? It's working before or after. Hmm. Right, or phishing, right, which attacks the person. And not the computer at all.
I know there's a I don't know if it's a hardware or software thing, but it actually measures your keystrokes, and it can actually tell what you're typing by the noise your keyboard made.
And actually, that was World War II.
There's an iPhone.
Yeah.
They did at George Tech. It's laying on the desk. The accelerometer measures the vibrations and the thing, and figures out what you're typing.
But that is as old as World War II. I mean, we've had eavesdropping systems that would. Was IBM Selectric typewriters. If you remember, they had the typewriter ball,
right,
which would move. There was very unique movements for each character. So you can, if you had a good enough microphone, you could listen to what was being typed just by the sound the typewriter would make. Mm-hmm. And that worked really great in other people's embassies. So that we had a field day with that for a while. Right? And it doesn't matter how good their crypto is. It's irrelevant.
So some would argue that IBM built a Selectric deliberately so that would be possible.
I've never heard that argument.
hang on, conspiracy words more often.
I was wondering about this argument. The point of cryptography is to protect the confidentiality and integrity of data. So what about the other part of the security triangle, the availability, that being a real threat, that being a bigger threat than being able to break the cryptography?
I think there's a lot of truth to that. People often ask me what's the single most important thing you should do for securing the computers, and I always tell them a good backup. Right? Because, you know, the thing that's going to happen that you're going to hate is you're going to lose your data. So availability is extremely important. Cryptography helps with availability. You know, if I'm going to put my backup on some cloud somewhere, I'm going to want to encrypt it. Right? So, and there are cryptographic schemes for error correction. I mean, cryptography does deal with availability. It's not as directly as confidentiality or authenticity or integrity or sort of any of those types of Y requirements. But you know, I agree, availability, and something that has nothing real, a lot of cases, nothing to do with what we're talking about here, is extraordinarily important. And in some cases, it's more important. I mean, it depends on who you are. Right? You know, it's if you are, and you can see this in how systems fail, whether they fail open or fail closed. Right? If you are, you know, talking on the phone and your encryption fails, you likely want to make the phone call. But if you are the military, you might actually not want to make the phone call. Right, if you are a bank and the ATM machines aren't secure, you kind of want to shut them down, right? But if you're Amazon and SSL's not working, you're going to take the damn book orders anyway, right? So it really does depend on what you're doing, which one of these requirements are more important.
One of the best hacks I've heard about availability regarding crypto is that some friends of mine had reverse engineered the little dongles, the RSA key IDs, and they realized that in the software, at least the host side software, those 30-second windows could possibly get out of sync a little bit. So every time you logged in, if your number was slightly close to the right window but slightly late this time, they would adjust a server-side number to say, oh, that's where his clock is now. Well, if you could figure out somebody else's numbers by breaking the seed, then you could slowly keep moving his server-side clock a little forward, a little forward, a little forward, till it was like 45 seconds away. So when the real guy comes along with the real numbers, he can't log in. So that's an example of a good feature initially as a design, but could be used as a denial of service.
We're running out of time, so let's see what we get.
All right, last question.
No, you get a penultimate question.
It's a rather silly or simple question. You said earlier, you know, the cryptography is really not really the problem, or in a lot of cases it's not. It's the passphrase, it's the users. And I hope I'm not misquoting you. I believe in your book, Secret and Lies, you said the general consensus was for a passphrase to be up to 90 characters. I hope I'm not misquoting
90?
That.
90? I doubt I said that.
I don't know if you said that.
I hope I
but
didn't.
But either way, whether it is that or not, what is the minimum? You know, we have so many systems out there that can break things super fast with brute force. You know, when it comes to your public or your keys, you know, what's the recommended length, and how do we memorize those? Because it's so easy to break these days.
So there's any number of pieces of advice, and it's not really length. It's difficulty to guess, because your password guesser isn't going to try, every password from A to Z. I mean, it's not going to try them. No, it's going to try them in commonality order. It'll try password first, then it'll try password one, then it'll try your first name, right? Then it'll try the dictionary. Then it'll try the dictionary with one next to it, dictionary with zero, dictionary with the E entered into a three. Right? I mean, and password guessers are actually really good at doing this. They will try every string that counts in Google, so it'll get like Led Zeppelin, right? It'll get stuff that isn't words but are common. So what you need to do is to have a password that's not on these lists, and there are two basic techniques that are out there that I think are valid. One is the XKCD technique, where he suggests picking, four or five words and stringing them together, having some mnemonic to remember them, which, you all can remember four words. Or the other technique is sort of my technique, which involves memorizing a sentence, right? an interview with Les Johnson, we will get to the stars. And having it be, the password be AIWLJ colon open quotes WWG capital T S exclamation point close quotes. Like, really nice password, great password. I mean, don't use this one because I just said it, right?
Everybody change your password to that tomorrow.
It's a it's a sentence, you're going to remember it.
That was my password.
Damn.
That was my luggage code. Poor TSA.
So both of those techniques will generate good passwords. You know, the sentence advice, I mean, a sentence you'd be embarrassed to write down, I think, is a good one. Right? Because you're less likely to write it down, and you're more likely to remember it. And you can do things with it, right? You know, you could be a sentence, you can, I mean, in this sentence, you can take the word stars and write out the whole word. So it's the first initials, but the last word, you write it out. I mean, and if you saw the book by the Guardian author on WikiLeaks, he produced the password that Assange had for his massive dump of State Department of cables, and it is a long English sentence, really nice password. So but that's the way you remember them. So either you pick, you know, a bunch of words that don't relate to each other and you have some clever way of remembering it, or pick a sentence and have a way you remember of generating the password from the sentence. All right, we have one time for one more question. So who wants to be the last question? You will be judged by your peers on the quality of this question.
You represent us all.
Who is still standing? Who haven't we heard from? Oh, he's going to pick one.
So a common theme I keep hearing over and over again is that the quality of would-be cryptographers is not always up to snuff, and the cost of really good cryptography is really high, and those two obviously seem to be related in concept.
Supply and demand,
right,
people.
But my real question would be, for all three of you actually, is what would you guys suggest for either aspiring cryptographers, current cryptographers, or even the general public to help reduce those costs and increase the quality of cryptographers in general? Because isn't that really what cryptography engineering needs, is people capable of implementing it?
Yes.
Why would I work to reduce my own paycheck?
That's a good answer,
so, okay.
I suppose.
Yeah. So what we need is more people in the field. I mean, and in the past 5-6 years, a bunch of universities offering good courses in cryptography, security engineering. This isn't the same problem we've had in previous decades. You know, it's a general problem in software engineering. I mean, there is zero unemployment in software engineering. There is negative unemployment. There are more jobs than there are people to fill them. And this is why big companies have people whose job it is to help foreign engineers come in and get visas. So, you know, more people into the field. And how do you do that? I mean, you know, you make it sound cool to your, you know, your kid brother. I don't know. But, you know, the more people who are studying this and learning this and doing it, the better we'll do. I mean, there's nothing magic here. I mean, this is no different than computer games people, right? We just need more of them. And companies are solving this because they can't bring the people to the jobs. They bring the jobs to the people. There's a lot of software engineering that gets exported to countries which have more software engineers than we have in the U.S.
Okay, so basically what you're saying is continue doing what we're doing, and his answer
over
there
better.
A little bit facetious was simply that, and actually it was kind of what I was worried about, is that I hear, I was, I guess, leading to the idea that one of the problems that we have is that so much of our system is all about secrecy and not also sharing as well. You know, because, you know, if you have a really good way of securing your stuff, you don't want to let that out in the open either.
But you do. And the nice thing about academic security is we do publish. If there's a clever idea, we all learn about it. It's not secret. It's open. Because if you have a clever idea, it's probably actually not very clever. Right? And the way you find out if it's clever is you tell all of us. And then we go, whoa, what a good idea. Or, boy, that really sucks, and here's how to make it better. right? That back and forth, that community, that peer review is so essential to security that we do publish. We do make, you know, we don't publish the key, we publish the mechanism to produce the key.
Okay, right? Sounds great.
And that is a core principle of cryptography, of security, and one that serves us really, really well. I mean, even inside the NSA, who never publishes anything, they have their own peers inside. The reason they can get away with not publishing, they have enough expertise within their walls. They can do that in their own little ecosystem. For the rest of us, we rely on each other. And that's not going to change.
And best that it happens at two levels, both the algorithms being published in the academic world, but also with open source crypto software, having lots of peers review how this algorithm was implemented. Was there a hole in it there? Open source has really done a lot to move that forward.
Okay, so I think we're out of time. Before we end, where are you going to be the rest of this con?
Probably in the green room. No, I'll be actually here, Hacking 101, Hacking 201. Definitely check those out. All you guys in the EFF track are probably familiar with that, but those are really great times to get more questions answered and stuff. That's my two next panels, yeah.
And?
I'm back tomorrow at 5:30 for the CISPA, PIPA, all the legislation that's busy going through Congress.
Hey, I'm on that too.
Yes, you are.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm here at 2:30. I'm talking about this book on trust, security, and society. And Sunday at 10 a.m., I'm going to talk about cyber war, which we hit on here a little bit, but I'll spend a lot more time on that. Those are two solo things. I'm on his thing, and then I'm doing a book signing Sunday at 11:30 a.m. I have no idea where. But I have 2 days to find out. Thank you very much.